Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 286 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris. We've got a great segment for you here today. We've been talking a fair amount of NBA summer happenings in the last couple of weeks on the program, NBA Summer League. We've been talking about the NBA free agency, some trades that have been made, coaching moves. We've been talking about a decent amount of that. But we're going to be getting into that even more deeply today in a discussion with Rick Bucher of NBC Sports and Comcast, a longtime of ESPN. He is going to be joining us to get into this subject matter. And again, we've had a tremendous time recently on the show getting into this. We haven't really delved into NBA summer happenings too much in the previous history of the show because, again, we are a show where nothing is off topic. So when you're going to be spread out as thin as you are, you're doing sports, non-sports, et cetera, it's hard to get into everything that you would necessarily like to get into. But our guest that we have today, he is, as we said, Comcast NBA analyst and NBC Sports NBA correspondent, radio host for 95.7 The Game out in Frisco. He is an afternoon host on the station. He is talking general sports. So we will get into some general things with him on the program because, again, you have some other very newsworthy teams in his general market. You have the defending NFC champion 49ers. You have the defending World Series champions, the San Francisco Giants. But the man is, of course, best known for covering the NBA. As we said, Comcast NBA analyst, NBC Sports NBA correspondent, as well as being radio host for 95.7 The Game. And on this talk show where nothing is off topic, I was racking my brain before to try to think, have we had a higher profile guest from the Bay Area than this gentleman since we had Steve Perry on? I think not. Dave Meltzer might perhaps raise his hand in protest, and I love and respect Dave Meltzer, but until the guy is on national TV a little bit more, I would have to concur that this gentleman probably is that, the highest profile guy that we've had on in the Bay Area since Steve Perry a little bit over 18 months ago. I've really been looking forward to this because few guys have their pulse more, their finger more firmly on the pulse of the NBA. I speak, of course, of Rick Bucher of Comcast Sports and NBC Sports. Rick, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the FDH Lounge. Thank you for joining us today, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Well, very very happy to get to have this conversation with you. And, again, there's a lot that's been going on this summer in the NBA. Things are starting to get a little bit quieter, starting to get to the dead zone of the NBA calendar as a whole. But I'd just like to start by checking with you and seeing, have there been any real big surprises to you this summer? I mean, the big two free agents, it wouldn't appear to be the case. CP3 staying put. Howard, if he was going anywhere, Houston had carved out probably perfect situation for him. If you're looking at non-free agency, the Doc Rivers thing maybe looms a little bit large. But have there been any too many things this summer that really made you say, hey, this is a real game changer and I didn't see that coming?
The only one that was the real shocker was that the Philadelphia 76ers moved Drew Holiday on draft night. I was told going in that Sam Hinkie would not be afraid, the new GM in Philadelphia, would not be afraid to tear it down and to start over. But I just never imagined that would include a 23-year-old all-star point guard. And it's quite a cachet for the Pelicans to pick up. It puts them, I think, in the playoff conversation. And in the meantime, it lets you know that the 76ers have no intention of attempting to be good this season, and that they are putting all their chips in the 2014 draft, which a lot of people expect to be very, very good. But on the face of it, to me, it's a huge roll of the dice to let a talent like Drew Holiday move along, even getting two first-round picks, including Nerlens Noel from this year's draft and a future pick for 2014.
Yeah, the 76ers, one of a number of teams, the Celtics included, where, you know, if there was a whole lot of truth in advertising, maybe they'd be coming out on the floor next year to the screens of Burn It Down by Linkin Park, because, you know, nobody really seems to be, you know, trying too hard unless they're a team that really feels they can make a big impact next year. I mean, I look at this coming off season next year, Rick. I mean, on the surface to me, it looks to be kind of a melding of 2010, where you had the big free agent class, and 2003, where you had, ironically, some of those same guys coming into the league, probably the best incoming class since 1992. Is it easy to make too much of this, or is next summer going to be pretty much all that?
Yeah, well, I think that you're seeing the impact of the collective bargaining agreement, the new collective bargaining agreement, more than anything, and the luxury tax, and teams looking at it and saying, number one, to be fiscally sound, we're going to have to build through the draft. The draft in the NBA is now going to become what it is for the NFL, in that is the way that you're going to be able to build your team. The rules and the restrictions on being able to acquire superstar free agents, while it will still happen to a certain degree, it's not going to be – I don't know that you're going to see another formulation of the Miami Heat. The blueprint of clearing the decks and then going out and collecting superstars, you may be able to do that with one, maybe two, but by and large, you're going to have to build through the draft. And so I know that while it's not technically a hard cap, that GMs and owners are looking at it, or GMs are getting their orders from the owners saying, whatever happens, I'm not incurring this luxury tax, which, as the collective bargaining agreement goes on, becomes more and more severe, where to the point where if you go $5 million over, you could be paying as much as $20 million in tax. Nobody wants to see that happen if they're writing the checks. And that's why I think you see this attitude of, look, if we can't compete, let's tear it down to the studs. Let's not be spending money when we can't be competitive, and we're just seeing it to an extreme degree.
Now, it's striking to me, Rick, when you mention the CBA and when you're talking about the changed landscape, I kind of wonder, is baseball kind of, in a way, a little bit of a canary in the coal mine for where the NBA is going? Because you look at a team like the Yankees, as they're finding out with A-Rod in this sort of, you know, post-PED era, that, again, you can be spending a whole lot of money, but if you're not spending money on, you know, the younger guys and the guys that are still playing with the teams that drafted them, you're probably not getting a lot of bang for the buck. You're looking at a sport now where it's dominated by guys in their 20s and in some cases early 20s, and that's a product of the farm system and drafting. And so you're saying that then that same level of importance is going to be in the NBA as far as player development and acquisition?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up with Alex Rodriguez and baseball, because we just discussed this off of the Dustin Pedroia signing. That when it comes to baseball, if you look at the guys that were pilfered from another team with $100 million contracts versus the guys that stayed with their teams, they were signed $100 million contracts to keep them, the success by and large has been, if you're going to spend that money and you're spending it on a guy that you developed and is under your wing, you have a much better chance of a successful return. And we broke it down, and Prince Fielder really is the best $100 million player that changed teams. All the other ones, you know, going back to Kevin Brown, even Pujols now, you go across the board, those guys have not paid off. When you look at the Derek Jeters or the Buster Posey's, that has been the return. So, I'm not sure that I can still relate baseball situation to the NBA's in the regard that I'm seeing some of the impact of the new collective bargaining agreement, but the reality is that baseball still doesn't have a cap and still is not operating as if they're expecting one anytime soon. And I do see the NBA looking at it and saying, hey, we're going to have to be a lot smarter with our money because of the rules that we've put in place. And basically what the NBA owners have done that Major League Baseball has not done is they've put rules in place to save them from themselves. It's just going to become inordinately difficult to be able to make the kind of mistakes that you see the New York Yankees making.
Absolutely. Yeah, great points on the similarities and differences. And I'm sure you've probably seen this, Rick, but with Fielder, and I would have to agree with you just off the top of my head as far as the impact of those guys, but I've seen in recent days some advanced statistics that show that, you know, he's tailing off a little bit even as of right now, whether that's momentary or not. Yeah, but that he's the best of the bunch. That is really kind of interesting. We started by talking NBA surprises for the summer, if there were any. One of the ones, at least if you were going to go back to the beginning of the summer, that might qualify as a little bit of a surprise, the team of which I am a lifelong fan, Cleveland Cavaliers, locking down Andrew Bynum. That wasn't necessarily on the radar at the start of the summer. You started to hear things a little bit more as it went along, as his options possibly declined. We mentioned Dwight Howard briefly in passing. This is a guy where, if healthy, maybe right there neck and neck with Dwight Howard. But, I mean, that's the magic question when it comes to a guy like Bynum. So what's your best sense heading into this season of what the Cavs can expect from him?
It's worth the risk in terms of the $6 million guaranteed. That's about all he has coming. It's the only kind of deal that makes any sort of sense, and it really only makes sense for a team like Cleveland. I don't think you can count on anything with Andrew Bynum, and I have I have grave doubts as to whether we're ever going to see him be an effective player again, simply because, let's face it, he had so much money on the table. No matter what you think of his work ethic, even Jerome James or Eddie Curry, when they realized that there was a big money ticket waiting for them, they were able to get it together in order to play and be in shape to get that money. I believe that Andrew Bynum wasn't able to because physically he's simply not capable. His knees do not allow him to train at the level necessary to be a big man in today's league. And by saying that, I mean you have to be more athletic and more agile than ever before because the pace of the game has increased. You've got to be able to get up and down the floor more. I just don't know physically that he's capable of it. We're certainly going to find out in Cleveland. But with it was a worthwhile risk for them. I think it's why you see all the interest in Greg Oden, is that we saw a little bit of a turn with the San Antonio Spurs getting to the finals and the Indiana Pacers doing what they did. There is, I think they're turning back the clock a little bit in that bigs in the NBA, there's a return to their value. But it can't just be any old big. It has to be a mobile athletic big to be effective. But those guys have value. I think it's why it's worth the risk for Cleveland with Bynum. I think it's why you will see somebody sign Greg Oden, but it remains to be seen, can those guys, they're big, they have the requisite athleticism, can they stay healthy? Can they play four games in 5 nights and get up and down the floor? If they can't, 7 feet on the bench does not block a whole lot of shots.
No, it doesn't. I would concur with you about Bynum being a good risk for the Cavs under the circumstances, even as I kind of wince when I hear statements from him like, well, there's great advances in medical science these days, and maybe I'll be able to regenerate some cartilage in my knees, because that's not exactly a hopeful point of view. But isn't it kind of brilliant also from the point of view of the front office and Dan Gilbert is saying we're all in this year, playoffs, et cetera? I mean, they have the perfect out. Really, if they don't make the playoffs this year, because then it's just kind of a shrug and like, hey, we tried. What else could we have done under the circumstances? It looks like they played that one perfectly in terms of keeping all the fans pacified.
Well, honestly, if you're in the Eastern Conference, I feel you everybody has a shot at the playoffs because the bottom of the of the Eastern Conference playoff picture is so soft. And, yeah, I mean, look, we can't ignore the fact that there was once upon a time Dan Gilbert said that, hey, we're going to win a championship before that guy down in Miami does, and we're now two championships later. It's almost as if, you know, Cleveland at this point has to demonstrate that they're moving in a positive direction. There are no shortcuts. Who knows? Maybe Bynum can offer them that. What's interesting to me with Cleveland is that since that guy down in Miami left, they have yet to sign another bona fide small forward. They've been mixing and matching at that position. And while I don't believe that LeBron is coming back to Cleveland anytime soon, it does continue to intrigue me that that's the one position. Like, you didn't hear them spending big money on an Andre Iguodala or going after, you know, any other potential small forwards that may be out there. They, for whatever reason, they have not shown an inclination to invest in that position. And until they do, the rumors that LeBron could someday come back to Cleveland are going to continue.
Absolutely. That's why folks like myself were advocating quite possibly Otto Porter in the draft this year. That would have done something to fill the spot there. But, yeah, no, it's very, very curious that they won't and they haven't. And, again, you know, you talk about Dan Gilbert's response, his kind of heated response that night and the fine that it drew from the league. I mean, not to be conspiracy guy, but I look at that. I look at the report that came out this summer from your old stomping grounds at the Four Letter Network about the Lakers allegedly putting out this statement, which I tend to believe as fact, of like, hey, guys, don't worry about it. We're going to sign LeBron and Carmelo next year. I mean, I look at something like that. Okay, I understand it doesn't have any bus fingerprints directly on it, but I think you have to be an idiot not to believe that that wasn't put out there to try to get the season ticket holders to stay calm through a tough year. Just interesting, isn't it, that there's not going to be any heat or blowback coming back from the league whatsoever for what looks to be a very transparent maneuver on their part?
Yeah, there's. I mean, it is. I do think you're right in that. But the league in general is there's more utilizing spinning in the media through trade rumors, through various rumors, than there ever has been before. And it's one of the things that kind of disturbs me that the media that we allow ourselves as never before to be used that way. That there are, I just feel there are too many people that are willing to take that, whatever it is, it sounds good, it sounds titillating, I'm going to throw it out there. And it used to be, you know what, you had to make an extra call or two, and you had to know that it had substance before you put it out there. And I feel that it weakens all of us in that we are willing pawns in the game that we're seeing played. And I do believe that it is in great part that, hey, you know, we may struggle this coming year, but there are better things ahead. All that said, you know, from everything I know about both LeBron and Carmelo, I can't see either one of those guys realistically being in a Lakers uniform next season. You didn't ask the question, but I thought I'd throw it out there.
Oh, well, no, I appreciate you volunteering that. Do you have any kind of sense on what might be most likely for them? I mean, LeBron's got to be looking at a very rapidly aging core in Miami. Obviously, he's got a lot of faith in Pat Riley to make things happen. But do you have an early sense on either one of those guys?
I really don't. I don't. And as far as Carmelo, I'd be very surprised if he's leaving New York. His wife was a big influence in getting him back there. The marketing opportunities were a big factor in getting him back there. I don't see him switching coasts again at this point. I know he and Kobe are close. If I had to handicap it, I'd say probably Carmelo is the better shot of going there than LeBron. With Pat Riley, I honestly would say that LeBron is going to go wherever Pat Riley goes. And if Pat Riley stays in Miami, I can't tell you the number of players that I've talked to who the magic of Pat Riley and his being able to spin a web that keeps you captivated and believing in his vision is unparalleled. And if he wants LeBron to continue to stay in Miami, I have to believe that there's a way that he's going to convince him to stay there. I honestly don't see another situation that makes sense for LeBron to go to other than to go back to Cleveland and repair the fences there, or if he's looking for the marketing opportunity, if he wants to become, you know, as he said, he wants to become the first billionaire athlete, that has to do with endorsements and marketing, then it would be New York. But I also don't see he and Carmelo fitting together on the floor. So when I add it all up, I have no reason to believe that as of right now that LeBron wouldn't be staying in Miami.
Yeah, that makes sense when you look at it that way, and everything it took to get him there, and many of the factors remaining in place, even if young legs of a Dwayne Wade are not among those factors. When you talk about Carmelo and possibly leaving New York, that reminds me a little bit of one of the big stories this week that hasn't really gotten a lot of play yet in NBA circles, but is certainly going to over the course of the next couple of years, that being the coming eviction of the Knicks, Madison Square Garden, et cetera, from the Penn Station site, and the fact that in 10 years they're going to have to be someplace else. You got to think this is going to set off a heck of a scramble. Obviously, the league is going to want to remain with a team in Manhattan. So what does it do with the real estate around there and everything? What's your early sense of how this is going to play out? Because clearly with putting $1 billion of renovations in there, this is one that Jim Dolan obviously thought he could game away.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I've heard at points that there was some other real estate in the vicinity that they were trying to make some gains on. But I'll be honest, I am not dialed in as to what their alternatives would be moving forward. And the real question becomes, and I don't think Dolan is one of these guys, but there's been so much turnover when it comes to ownership in the NBA in particular, I think in sports in general, and the type of owners that we see, it's really a cash in, cash out sort of business now. We don't see the long standing owners and it being handed down through the family. We see a little bit of that. We see that in some of the old school situations with, obviously, like the Lakers with Jerry Buss down to Jim and Jeannie. But by and large, it's become, how do I monetize this thing? And I could see where if something does not fit for Dolan and there's somebody else who has the real estate who can make it happen, I could see him cashing out.
That would be very interesting. You're the first person I've heard raise that as a possibility. So, I suppose anything's possible under the circumstances. It has to be a bitter disappointment to him as far as how it played out. As far as what the league's reaction is going to be to this, that raises another interesting element. We talked a little bit about 2014, and, of course, next year will be the transition from David Stern as commissioner of the league to Adam Silver. And I'm kind of reminded of that phrase from back in the 60s in Czechoslovakia, socialism with a human face. Is there any kind of an analogy here with Adam Silver, maybe some of the same policies, but a little bit less willing to come off as a jerk in public in the way he handles things than David Stern?
Oh, I think he's going to have a completely different approach. The question that I have with Adam Silver, and it's what David Stern ran into at the end, which I think is why he began to come off as more iron-fisted than ever, is that he was having more and more difficulty. He couldn't rule with a soft hand because he no longer had people following him as willingly as he did when he was leading a bunch of guys whose league was on the brink, and he saved it and he made them a ton of money. Guys were investing $10 million and suddenly they had franchises worth $100 million. Now he has guys that are buying in for $350 and $400 and they want to know where their return is. That becomes increasingly difficult to get people to simply walk in lockstep with you and agree to whatever it is that you are doing or saying. And that may be not only with your owners, but with the media, with everybody. And so I think that's where we saw David Stern's fangs a little bit more. Now, Adam Silver doesn't have that kind of personality, and yet he faces kind of the same issue in terms of he's got to keep all these owners happy and content, and how is he going to increase their profit margin? That ultimately is what they listen to, and he's going to have to be very, very savvy and very smart about that, and that's why I think you already hear the buzz about endorsements on uniforms and on courts, and he has to find a way to continue to monetize this league and bring a positive rate of return, and that's going to take some creativity and some innovation, and maybe some changes that are going to be rather apparent to us all.
Well, yeah, a real stink bomb that he dropped in Adam Silver's lap, if I may editorialize for a moment, is the Seattle situation. I have to agree with much of what you said about that with Sacramento. It seemed like, relatively speaking, a fairly pain-free way to get this iconic franchise returned to the Pacific Northwest. But it didn't come about that way. I know that you've taken some heat from some folks in Sacramento who are maybe a little too close to the situation, if I may further editorialize. But how do you think this is going to play out? Because I can't see the league going to 31 teams, because that might present some scheduling difficulties, imbalances in divisions, et cetera. That means you got to find a 32nd market, if I'm right about that. How's this playing out? And is Adam Silver saying, "Gee, thanks for leaving me this"?
Yeah, no, I think you're right on it as far as expansion is concerned. I don't see it going to 31 or to 32. There are some teams in some weaker markets that I could easily see moving at some point. Milwaukee is probably at the top of that list. Memphis less so, just because of their lease situation. But Milwaukee is, Milwaukee needs a new arena. And while the senator there, Herb Kohl, has held on to that team for a long time, I could see where he might be willing to move on. We've seen, as I said, a lot of the old guard move on and cash out. And that would be an ideal situation where you take a team to Seattle, where a lot of things are already in place. You know, and still remains to be seen, quite honestly, with Sacramento. And this is probably not going to win me any more friends in Sacramento, but I've been told that they still have a lot of work to get that arena deal done, and that the team staying there is contingent. And that if they don't, I think the last thing I heard was that they need to have a shovel in the ground. And I know it seems a long ways away, but 2015, if they don't have a shovel in the ground, they're going to have difficulty meeting the 2017 deadline to have that arena done. And if they don't, then the league is not going to stand by keeping the franchise there. That is a prerequisite to keeping the franchise in Sacramento. I have nothing against Sacramento. I've said that many times, but I look at it as a market, and I'm just skeptical whether it can operate successfully in today's NBA, much like I'm skeptical about New Orleans. The saving grace there is that they're connected. They're owned by the same guy who owns the Saints. So he has some synergy working for him. It's why I have skepticism about Milwaukee and Memphis. If you're not a great team in Memphis, I think that the attendance falls off dramatically, and it no longer becomes a functional and profitable option in Memphis. And I put Sacramento in the same category, and so. It remains to be seen whether that is going to work, but I do, looking around the landscape, I do believe there's a couple other teams, a couple other franchises that if they were sold or if they should come on the market, are an easy move to the Seattle market, which no one doubts is much healthier than four or five of the existing markets in the NBA.
Well, those are great points, Rick. I'm thinking of two things in particular that come to mind from what you said. Number one, Herb Kohl, looking at the options he's got, pretty lucky he doesn't have to face the voters again, because he would not be very popular going that way, obviously. And on the Sacramento thing, one of the guys I saw that was the most butthurt by your analysis about this is a guy that I heard one time subbing for Jim Rome, proclaiming Jim Rutherford to be the second coming. So I think that kind of shows you the tenor of some of the folks in Sacramento and, you know, how much they're to be believed on, how much that legitimacy that franchise has to hold on that market. As far as markets go, let's just turn it around here at the end if we can and touch on some of the other things that you're covering at 95.7. The 49ers, I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. They're my preseason Super Bowl favorite, as they are for a lot of folks here. They look like the best balanced team in the league on paper. What's the sense out there heading into training camp?
Certainly, I think there's optimism about that. There's obviously the Michael Crabtree injury cast a little doubt in that direction. Colin Kaepernick and all he's done during the offseason raised some eyebrows, but people that know him have no doubt that while he might have been at the ESPYs at night, that he was in the gym from 6 a.m. to noon in the morning, and people expect him to take another step forward. I think the biggest challenge and why I am I'm cautious about what the 49ers are of the I'm cautious about saying that the 49ers are going to win it, do what they did not do last season, that they're going to complete the mission, is that it's been, I don't know, almost 40 years since we've seen a team lose in the Super Bowl and then come back the next year and win it. And when I look at their division, depending on how Carson Palmer performs in Arizona, if he can give them something, I look at that team, that's the weakest of the four. I just talked to Mark Schlereth today, and he said, don't sleep on the St. Louis Rams and their front four. We already know what the Seahawks are and what a bloodbath that's going to be. So when I look at that, they have the depth. On paper, you like everything about, the 49ers. You can check off all the boxes. I just wonder whether expecting a team to make that march two consecutive years in a row in today's NFL, when you're playing in a division that is going to take as much out of them as I expect this one will, whether we're being a little too optimistic. Injuries and health and the luck that is a part of that always plays such a big role in deciding who ultimately takes it. And they're going to have to defy the odds in that in those categories just because of the tough battles that they're going to have to go through to get there, and doing it on a shorter off season than everybody but the Baltimore Ravens have.
Great point. And again, by definition, that would be three consecutive trips just back to Championship Sunday, which is a tremendous rarity in this day and age because they were there, of course, the year before. Yep. Well, I got to ask you, Rick, because this is something I've called my shot on the show previously here as far as predictions go. Rivalry of the 2010s, 49ers-Seahawks. That's my guess. How much validity does that have in your mind?
Oh, I think that's good. I think it's a great pick just because you have two – established coaches, you have two established franchises who are in great shape as far as spending money. They have the front office to do the work. You've got young quarterbacks, obviously a key position to fill. You've got two great ones there, and all the dynamics are already there. So I'm right there with you, and I got to tell you, I don't know how it's going to play out, but I can't wait to see the 49ers and the Seahawks go at it this season.
Yeah, I think those are the two most anticipated regular season games. I really do. I think they're going to be amazing. As far as it goes with the other team in San Francisco, I talked about balance for the 49ers. I don't know that even in the two World Series seasons we would have said that about the Giants with that lineup. But, they've really kind of regressed again this year. Is it just a matter of that they're sort of the Brett Saberhagen of the 2010s here, where it's every other year? Is it a year where is it the thing where the smoke and mirrors doesn't materialize in 2011 and 2013 and the lineup gets exposed a little bit? Is it the inexplicable kind of falling off of Matt Cain this season to match what happened with Lincecum earlier? Is it kind of all of the above or none of the above?
Yeah, no, I think it's a combination of events here. I look at the way they won both World Series, and they did it in unusual fashion. The pitching was obviously there, and the offense caught lightning in a bottle at just the right time. They made some key additions both seasons late. But I remember so distinctly that first run and how, I mean, people know how remarkable this last run was, in which they were on the brink of being eliminated practically every series, every game. They fall behind, and then they just staved off elimination until they get to the championship series and caught the Tigers napping, I believe, a little bit, and took advantage and snuck away with a World Series. But I remember distinctly 2010 because my kids were just old enough where I was taking them to their first baseball game at AT&T Park, and it was mid to late August. I want to say August 19th, and the Giants lost to the Marlins 5-1, and they just looked dead in the water. They were going nowhere, and my kids could not have been more bored. And I thought, okay, well, one, they're not just going to be they're not going to be baseball fans, and two, you know what? I can see why. There was nothing exciting about the Giants. And then the next thing I know, my kids are coming home and saying, "Hey, Dad, we got to watch them. They're playing the Phillies tonight." I'm like, "What?" You know, they suddenly became interested, and it was like a torch going up. That's how the Giants did it both years. When you look at this group now and you look at how they've had to grind that pitching staff to do what they've done, that was their ace in the hole, and now they have to fix that. And so it's not just trying to get a few bats. It's really trying to restore that starting pitching staff and probably some work in the bullpen as well. And it's why I appreciate what two of the last 3 years were, because I think that's not going to be an easy order of business. I wouldn't say that it's an every other year thing. I would say that they won 2 out of 3 in the unlikeliest fashion, and now it's going to take some real work to put this thing back together and make it competitive at that level again.
I couldn't agree more in looking at it. And yet the strange thing is they've had a very good record, I think about a 580 winning percentage in division this year. So even that part of it doesn't really add up.
Yeah, although you know, Dodgers early on were not good. To me, it may be the weakest division in baseball, and I think it almost underscores just how bad they are, in that they have that, and they are where they are in the division, and when you see them go outside of the division or go on the road, they really get exposed for their frailties.
Weakest division in baseball. All I can say, Rick, is, as a lifelong Indians fan, the American League Central says hi.
Understood.
But yeah, the NL West is right there as well, no question about it. Rick, as I knew it would be, a tremendous conversation with you, sir. I know, again, you've got the afternoon show, 95.7, The Game, covering the NBA for Comcast, NBC Sports. Anything else we missed in there that we should be plugging?
No, I think that's enough. I think that's enough.
Okay. Well, again, an absolute pleasure, Rick. A wonderful conversation with you, sir. Thank you for all of the insight and analysis, and I would love to have you back on again sometime, sir.
You got it. Happy to do it.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Rick, and thank you all for joining us, FDH Lounge, mini episode number 286.